Good evening, everyone. My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
It's good to be here. Happy holidays. I'm from Santa Monica. My home group is the, as outlined in the book, group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Tuesday nights at the corner of Second Hill in Santa Monica, if you're ever down that way. We call ourselves that because we try to do what's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Couple comments. No one ever gets sober on New Year's Eve. That's unbelievable. I never had trouble between Christmas and New Year's. It was always between New Year's and Christmas. Welcome to the new people, and happy birthday to all the birthday people this month. I don't wear a tie out of respect to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a story to that. I went to do this one time several years ago, and I went in the bathroom and got on my knees to say a prayer. And when I got up, my tie had been resting in the toilet. And I learned that night the difference between humility and humiliation. And I think it was that it was humility when I went down on my knees, and it was humiliation when I got back up. So out of respect to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't always wear a tie. Another thought I had, I shared with Dick on the way from the airport, is if wearing a tie is the only way I can show respect to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in big trouble. And there's a lot of ways to show respect to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like being honest. And the best definition of honesty that I've ever heard, of course it came from another alcoholic, is that you say what you're going to do, and then you do what you say you're going to do. And if I look at every inventory I've ever written and every amends I've ever made, it had to do with me not saying what I'm going to do or doing what I say I'm going to do. So I try to live that way. If there's a problem trying to live that way, if you don't have any power. And the problem trying to live that way when you don't have any power is that you can't live that way when you don't have any power. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to know a couple things. I do not know less than I did when I got here. I haven't gotten stupider. God gave me a brain to use, and He even gave me a new mind to begin to rely on. I do not believe my mind is a dangerous neighborhood that I shouldn't go in alone. And I don't want to stay sick. I think there's a lot of overlooked stuff in this program that I was encouraged to go for from the very beginning. Because on the first page of the first foreword to the first edition to the first book ever printed, they said that I could recover from alcoholism. I don't want to be 15, 20, 30 years sober still recovering from something that I had. That doesn't mean I'm cured if you're new. That means I am not suffering from the disease of alcoholism as I stand here tonight, because I'm not obsessed about alcohol, I don't have any in my system, and I'm in a pretty good fit spiritual condition. And that's all three parts to my disease. But when I got here, I didn't know it was a threefold disease, and I thought it should have gone away the further I got away from my last drink, because alcohol's the problem, don't you know? It took me a while being around here to find out that alcohol was not my problem. It just got me in a lot of trouble. As a matter of fact, it was one of the only solutions to a much deeper problem that I used to pour alcohol on. And in 10 treatment centers and 7 colleges, I might be alky, but I'm not stupid. Right? And a master's degree in psychology, they never told me the third part to the disease of alcoholism. I have a theory why, but that's probably about all it is. And I think the reason why is because you can't tell someone the third part of alcoholism if you're charging money. It just doesn't jive. There's a lot of places that say that they are friends of ours. I don't know whether they are or they aren't. I just know this. You cannot carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and charge money. Because here's what you'd have to do. The first couple of weeks, you'd have to tell them really what's wrong with them. Without any big words, without any film strips, without mentioning the word THIQ or neurotransmitters or chemical enzyme reactions in the body, you would just have to plain sit down and tell them that you're bodily and mentally different from normal people because you can't control booze. But what do? They keep it up here in your head. I know. I went to so many treatment centers, I became a therapist in one. That's just what you do after you've been to 6 or 7 and you haven't found out the answer to that question that's in the back of your mind yet. And that question was, what's wrong with me? Then the third week you'd have to tell them the bad news is you also suffer from an illness that no human power can relieve. Here's your bill. You can't do it. You got to tell them a little bit about what's wrong with them, and then the next 2 weeks, tell them everything they can do to prevent that from ever happening again and how they can manage their life and deal with their feelings. In Southern California, there's a saying that it's like fingernails on a chalkboard. Whenever I hear it, somebody up at the podium will say, I have no power over people, places, and things. The only one I can change is myself. What about this idea? I have power over people, places, and things. The only one I can't change is myself. There are people and places and things that don't want anything to do with me ever again because of the power that I had over them. Anyone who says they don't have power over people, places, and things has never made an 8-step list. All right. I used to have this really great attachment to my drunkologue. I really liked it. And I thought you should really like it. And the way it went was what it was like, because hadn't nothing happened, and it was like just about like it was before. You ever go to a conference and the speaker says, I'm not going to talk a lot about my drinking. Oh, my God. Hold on to your hat, right? Or they do this one. I don't have that much to share tonight. Woo. Might as well get comfy, right? I was at one of these things once. Patty reminds me of my spiritual advisor who just turned 35. She's a woman in Denver, Colorado, who runs the Denver Central Office where I got sober. And we were at one of these things once, and the speaker was going on and on and on. She leaned over to me and she said, I think I want him to get sober more than his family did. But I used to have this attachment to my drunkologue, and I don't know if anyone will understand this. I'm sure there's someone in the room that will. I'm sure there's people in the room that know what it's like to drink with a head full of AA and that we can screw up somebody's drinking for them. But I wonder if anybody in the room knows about somebody in AA screwing up your drunkologue. And I'll tell you how that happened. I was in my first 90 days. I got sober in Denver, Colorado, August 17th, 1982. And I was doing 90 meetings in 90 days. Of course, if one meeting a day is good, then three is better if you're alcoholic. If you're not, you'll probably complain about having to go to 90 meetings. And I was doing 90 in 90, and I heard a lot of things that you all said, but I heard them wrong. I heard you say, go to meetings, get a sponsor, read the book, and work the steps. I thought you said, going to meetings and getting a sponsor and reading the book and working the steps are the things that will keep you sober. That's what I thought you said. And in those 90 days, I saw people go to more meetings than me drink. And I saw people that knew the book better than me drink. And I saw people who spent more time with their sponsor than I did drink. And I have since seen people work the steps and forget a few simple things like they're not the ones keeping themselves sober. And they drank. And at the end, at 5.5 months, just before my 6 months, I reached this place that was like the most wonderful, horrible day of my life. And I think only another alcoholic would understand a day being really, really great and terrible. Because it didn't feel good, but it was my saving. It was like the day I hit bottom with the second half of step one. And I asked this man to be my sponsor. I heard in my very first meeting in a in my last treatment center, and he said he only knew one way to do it, and that was we were going to start on the title page of that book, and we were going to go through the first 164 pages together. My life's never been the same. And I said to him that day that we met, I said, Don, I said, I thought you said when I was new that if I read the book and got a sponsor and worked the steps and went to meetings, I would stay sober. Those are the things that would keep me sober. He said, no, we just hoped all of those things together would get you in touch with a power that would keep you sober. And all of a sudden I saw what I do is I'll worship the finger and not see what it's pointing to. And I have variously worshipped every finger in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, unaware of what it points to. And see, because I want to take the credit. So backing up just a little bit, in my first 90 days, I came down from one of these meetings at a club in Denver called 1311 York Street. And it's a big mansion with meetings on every floor and a club down on the first floor. And I came down from the meeting. There's this scary, great big guy over by the coffee machine. He's an ex-sheep herder and a lawyer, which is a dangerous combination. And he motioned for me to come over to the coffee place, and he asked me, "Do I want to have a cup of coffee?" And we sat down. We started to talk, and in the middle of the conversation, he asked me a really interesting question. He said, he said, why do you think you're alcoholic? And I thought, what? He said, yeah, why do you think you're alcoholic? I said, well, I'm in these rooms. He said, let me tell you something. I'm not one of these people that believe if you're in the room, you're in the right place. He said, those are people that don't want to spend time with new people anymore that have that look in their eyes like you do, like, what's wrong with me? And they want to lump us all together like we're supposed to know that we're in the right place. He said, why do you think you're alcoholic? Let me tell you a story about somebody in these rooms that found out they weren't in the right place. And our group, the group I belong to, has helped a lot of people find out this isn't where they belong. And they thanked us, and they got free, and they got to go on with their lives. That doesn't mean we go around telling people to drink. That means we're more interested in helping people find out their own truth and just quit complaining about all the stuff going on in AA if you're not doing anything about it. A girl came to our group a couple years ago with 8.5 years of sobriety. She wondered why after all that time she didn't feel really connected. She wondered why after all that time she'd never sponsored anybody. I think that was by the grace of God, but that's another story. She wondered why after 8.5 years she was doing everything in AA but AA. Which isn't hard to do nowadays. You can be in AA doing everything but the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she met a girl in our group that has what she wants, and they sat down, they started looking at the process There's actually a process outlined in this book. And they started looking at it, and she says to this girl about 3 weeks into it, she says, "I need to tell you something." She says, "I'm not alcoholic. This doesn't happen to me with alcohol, but I love being around you guys." And when she talks about being around one of us, it's like one of us talking about drinking. Her eyes light up and her blood starts flowing and her energy increases, just like one of you talking about drinking. She found out where she belongs and that she needs to do this work, and it's in the program of Al-Anon. And she got free to seek God with her own truth. And I'm very much in love with that girl, and I'd like to spend the rest of my life with her. And she can't come to my home group because it's a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for alcoholics only. And we do that because we respect AA. Guy comes up to me the other night at my home group and he says, "You know, I come to this meeting, but I'm not alcoholic." I said, "You're not welcome here." He said, "I come here and I say I'm alcoholic." I said, "Then we can't stop anybody who says they're alcoholic." He says, "But I say I'm alcoholic out of respect to Alcoholics Anonymous." I say, "No, you don't. You do that out of disrespect to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he thought about it for a little while and he thanked me. So this man sat with me and he said, "Why do you think you're alcoholic?" I said, "Well, I've been to treatment 10 times. He shook his head. He said, "Well, there's people that go to treatment more than once that can drink tremendous amounts of booze and might even kill them before their time, and they can get in lots of trouble that are about as much alcoholic as the man in the moon." And he said, "You know what? Some of us have never been to treatment. What does that mean? We're not?" So I had to grab on something else. And see, what my ego wants to do is always grab on something out here for why I am the way I am in here. I'm like the guy who's been sober forever, God forbid, and he's on his deathbed. And he looks up at his wife and he says, "Honey, after all these years, I've realized something." She says, "What's that?" He says, "Well, you were right there when I got shot that time and you stood by me." And he says, "And you were right there that time I lost all our money in business and you stood by me. And you were right there that time I had a stroke and you stood by me. And you've always been right there and you've always stood by me. And after all these years, I've realized something." She says, "What's that?" He says, "You're a friggin' jinx." That's how I think. That's how I think. He said, "Well, then why do you think you're alcoholic?" I said, "Well, alcohol put me in the Michigan State Penitentiary." He said, "Wait just a second. If you're new, you need to know there's certain phrases around here that if they're said, you need to be real careful when they're said. Like, wait just a second. It doesn't mean wait just a second. It means in a matter of moments, I'm going to smash what you just said into a million pieces." Right? That's like when your sponsor says, "Do you really want to know why?" Right? I went to my sponsor one time, and they say things that don't feel good. Because maybe they care more about you than how you might feel about anything they have to say. That's hard to do when all you're consumed with is what somebody's going to think about what you have to say, and you're just thinking of yourself. You're not thinking of the other person and what needs to be said. You're thinking of what they're going to think about what you have to say. And your mind goes through whole conversations that you've never even had, and you think you've had them by the time you're done. "Oh, I don't like you. Don't you remember what we've talked about?" "No, we've never talked," right? That's like when you're new and she enters the room, right? She enters the room and your eyes meet. And she sits down and takes her seat and enjoys the meeting and has a great time. And by the end of the meeting, you've broken up and you don't even want to talk to her. You've had kids, you've named the kids, you've had the kids, she's dumped you, she's gotten all your money, taken advantage of you, and left by the time the meeting's over. She's had a great time, right? Uh, So I say to my sponsor, I said, Don, I feel terribly inferior and insecure. His eyes light up. He says, would you like to know why? I knew. I don't think about it. I said, sure, I've been looking for the answer to that for 12 years in therapy. He said, would you really like to know why you feel inferior and insecure? I said, yeah. He said, because you're inferior and insecure. That's pretty simple for a complicated Freudian kind of guy like me, right? I always thought when I found out what was wrong with me that it was going to be really heavy. And it was probably going to be Freudian and really complicated. Most of you wouldn't understand. And there'd be someone to blame. I don't like using this word, but there's only one way to say it. If I was new nowadays, I'd definitely have a shit happens bumper sticker on my car, right? Because I want to remain a victim. I don't want to take responsibility. I don't want to see that every resentment I've ever had, I played a part. That my selfishness and my self-seeking and my dishonesty and my fear played a part with every resentment I've ever had, without fail, every inventory I've ever written. First thing someone always says, how does a little five-year-old kid see his responsibility for something that maybe was really outrageously terrible? That happened to a little innocent child. Well, you don't, but you get to see what you did with it for the next 30 years that was really selfish and self-centered and self-seeking and dishonest and fearful. But I can tell you about playing God way before I ever took a drink with a man who was 57 years old when I was born. But I'll tell you how this other man messed up my drunkalog. I told him that alcohol put me in the Michigan State Penitentiary, and he said, wait just a second. He said, why did they put you in the Michigan State Penitentiary? I said, well, I wrote $25,000 worth of checks on someone else's account. He said, oh, then forgery put you in the Michigan State Penitentiary. I said, yeah. He said, you know what? There's people in penitentiaries all over this world who can drink tremendous amounts of alcohol, end up in trouble, go to the penitentiary, that are about as much alcoholic as the man in the moon. And he said, you know what? Some of us have never been to the penitentiary. What does that mean? We're not. And I didn't know, because I was new, I didn't know. That excuse only lasts for so long, right? Unless you're one of these that just, your mind starts to melt the longer you're here and you know less than when you got here, right? I didn't know he was describing a guy that's described in our book. A hard drinker who can drink tremendous amounts of booze, have a habit, gradually impaired physically and mentally, might even die a few years before his time. Alcohol might even kill him, but given a sufficient reason, he can stop. Not powerless, not alcoholic. My mind thinks anybody who dies from alcohol needed our program, and anybody with a drinking problem belongs in AA. And anybody who can drink a tremendous amount of booze and end up in treatment or the Michigan State Penitentiary definitely belongs in our program. That's not what the book Alcoholics Anonymous says. I didn't know he was describing that guy, the hard drinker, to me. And he started to talk to me about what our big book takes about the first 53 pages just to get across two ideas. He started to talk to me about these two ideas that joined me to every alcoholic in this room, because what I realized that night, what my ego had done, was it was using the things that separate me from you to tell you why I'm one of you. My ego had once again done its deal. If you can understand one thing about the ego, you won't be able to defeat it. You won't be able to stop it from happening. But at least you'll be a little more aware of the game that it'll try to play on you. The main function of my ego, if you be alcoholic, is to put you back on a bar stool, unable to move, messing everybody in your life over. Because that's where it wants you. Because if you're like me, you have an ego that probably thinks it'll exist without you. Every inventory I've ever written, I got stuff in that inventory that says, hey, try it. Check it out. You'll be fine. Ain't nothing going to happen. It thinks it would go on without me. I think it probably would, right? And all of a sudden, sitting there with that man, I realized my ego had won once again. But I had been given some grace to see what it had done. And it was using the common differences that you and I don't share for me to try to fit in with you. Because see, what my ego wants to do is to separate me from you just long enough to put me back on a bar stool. It either wants me better or it wants me worse. I always thought ego was me just thinking that I'm a great, wonderful guy, probably much better than most of you. Ego is also me thinking I'm probably worse than most of you and no one, I can't be helped. It's the same ego, it's just a different end of the same scale. Anything to separate me from you. It now takes the good stuff from me to use against you. I've pretty much rejected being really selfish or dishonest or sticking guns in people's faces or the kind of stuff that I used to do. I've pretty much rejected that kind of stuff. But now it'll take the good stuff. This man that I study with talks about the ego of the alcoholic will use the best of you now that you've been around for a while. You want to read a very interesting man, once again, another non-alcoholic. I always love when I hear medicine and psychiatry and religion put down in AA because the whole program comes from non-alcoholics who are in medicine and psychiatry and religion. The first step comes from a non-alcoholic MD and a non-alcoholic psychiatrist. And the other 11 comes from some really religious people in a movement called the Oxford Group. And another guy who gave us a piece of information that a lot of alcoholics don't even know about is Dr. Harry Thibault, who wrote in a lot of our history books about the reconstruction of the ego after having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps and the need for reworking and reworking the first 9 steps on a regular basis. I do not come from the school that says 1 through 9 once and live in 10, 11, and 12 the rest of your life, because nowhere in AA literature is that said. And the sponsorship lineage that I come from, which I'm proud to be a part of, my sponsor is a man named Don P. from Denver who now lives in North Carolina. He's gone from a prisoner in the Colorado State Penitentiary to the director of the Department of Corrections for the state of North Carolina. He's the kind of man who's not in a place where he got there on his own power. And I like hanging out with those kind of people because I can't get anywhere on my own power. And I like being around people who need power, not the people in AA that think they have some. Because where I live in Southern California, they tell newcomers like me to just not drink no matter what. And if I could just not drink no matter what, why in the world would I need Alcoholics Anonymous? You can't just not drink no matter what and admit you're powerless over alcohol in the same breath. They just don't fit. Matter of fact, and I'd love to talk to anybody that would like to talk about this, if there's anything you can do to keep yourself sober, then you're not powerless over alcohol. And I'm here because there's nothing I can do to keep myself sober. A man came to our group. Our group does an interesting thing on Tuesday nights. We're allowed to talk to each other. I know it's a radical idea, but we're allowed to talk to each other before, during, and after the meeting, and we're allowed to ask each other, I know it's a radical idea, but we're actually allowed to ask each other questions in the meeting. And because we're 60 people and sitting in a circle, and couple circles. A man came to our group a couple weeks ago, and he said, there's only one reason to work the steps, and if you're working the steps for any other reason, you're wrong. And I wanted to hear what this reason was, and he says, the reason to work the steps is to overcome alcoholism. And I raised my hand and I said, what if you were working the steps because you can't overcome alcoholism? He said, That's like the night I was praying for the willingness to make amends to an ex-girlfriend. And I had the nerve at my meeting to say, I'm praying for the willingness to make amends. This little ex-Crip gang member that I used to sponsor raises his hand, and in our group, if they start a question with, is it possible, you're in big trouble. You might as well just get right under the chair. And in my pious way, while I was sharing, I said, I'm praying for the willingness to make amends. And he knew me a little bit, and he raised his hand. He said, is it possible you're not, and you'll know the moment you are? I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, the moment you're willing to make that amends, you're going to hear a really strange noise. I said, what? I never heard anything like that in my life. He said, yeah, the moment you're willing to make that amends, you're going to hear a really strange noise. I said, like what? He said, like this. And you know what? The moment I was willing to make that amends, I heard a really strange noise. Me knocking on her door, right? So this scary guy, this ex-sheepherder who's now a lawyer I was sitting with at 1311 York Street, who was messing up my drunkalogue, started to talk to me about two things the Big Book spends 53 out of 164 pages just to get across to a lunkhead like me, except they do it in a lot of different ways. They use a doctor, the utmost guy in the field of drug addiction and alcoholism at the time, to get across his opinion. They use our founder. They use stories about jaywalkers and car salesmen, and they use the father of modern-day psychology. They use point-blank declarations just to get across the two ideas this man was talking about. Once I start, I can't stop, and every time I stop, I can't stay stopped. Or, as the book puts it, 53 pages later, then on the 54th page, they repeat themselves to a knucklehead like me. They say, when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely, and when drinking, you have little control over the amount, you're probably alcoholic. And that's why I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm not powerless over alcohol, but you know, we hear a lot about the yets. I haven't done that yet, I haven't done that yet, I haven't done that yet. But what about the if onlys? And I can't be that unique. I'm not any more special or better or different than any alcoholic in this room. And I had the if onlys going on. Someone else must relate to this. And when I was new, it went like this. If only he hadn't been like that, I wouldn't have turned out the way I did. If only I hadn't gone there with those guys, I wouldn't have turned out the way I did. If only I hadn't gone to that school that year with those people, I wouldn't have turned out the way I did. And I'm sitting in a meeting one day in Alcoholics Anonymous in my first 90 days, and a guy tells my little if only story, and he turned out just as sick as I did. And the lie got smashed. And I believe if this path is about seeking truth, which it has been for me, every time you see some truth, you've already seen the lie. Can't see the truth without seeing the lie you believed just before you saw it. They always say that. They always leave off the end of these wonderful sounding spiritual principles. Like, the truth will set you free. Doesn't that sound great? They never said, though, but before it does, it'll piss the hell off. It'll piss you off, right? They never told you that. Imagine if you were new and they put you in a room and they told you all the paradoxes of the spiritual path in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the practical stuff that you need to grab onto when you're... Like, pick up that chair and move it over there. Right? That's about as heavy as it gets when you're new. Right? Take that ashtray and clean it. Right? But imagine taking a guy with half of his sense left, just a little bit of sense left, and put him in a room and tell him something like this. You say, now, Joe, now, check this out. We know you've never been to a meeting. You've been drinking for 18 years, but check this out. If you admit you have no power, you'll receive more than you have ever been given. But as long as you think you have any at all, you'll never get any more than you already have, which is little or nothing at all. And you go, what? And they go, yeah. If you admit you don't have any power, that's when you receive power. But as long as you think you have any at all, you're not going to get any more than you already have, which is little or nothing at all. Right? And then one day you go, oh, it's not all that stuff I've been doing that's been keeping me sober. We don't know. It's all a big trick. It's all a big trick these old guys have planned to give us the stuff they don't want to do anymore that we can do so we can take the credit for keeping ourselves sober for a while until we just find out it's just by the grace of God. And by that time, you've done all the commitments that they wanted you to take in the first place. I was 7.5 years sober writing inventory one time. And off the end of my pen came a realization that had nothing to do with what I was writing about. And that's the way it happens most of the time. And I'm writing something, and off the end of my pen comes, and I go, my God, I'm suffering from a form of denial stronger than the denial I came here with that we don't talk about. And once again, I don't think I'm unique. And I've talked to a lot of friends who have had it too. We talk about that other kind of denial a lot. To deny the disease you suffer from, the only disease that tells you you don't have one. We talk about that kind of denial a lot. But I was in a form of denial 7.5 years away from my last drink, stronger than the denial I came here with. And it comes out real subtle. I didn't hear it tonight, but in Southern California, you get up to take a birthday cake and somebody will go, how'd you do it? You go, what? And they'll go, how'd you do it? And you go, my name's Joe and I'm an alcoholic, and that means I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. And then you spend 10 or 15 minutes telling them how you keep yourself sober and manage your life. Sometimes it's not me writing inventory and off the end of my pen comes, I'm taking the credit for what I've been given, and all of a sudden, it's not a free, undeserved, unearned gift. It's something I deserve. It's something I've earned. And when those words start to creep into my consciousness, I'm in big trouble. I remember the first time I went to my sponsor when I was new, and it was either something really bad or something really good, but when you're new, it doesn't really matter. And I went to my I went to my sponsor and I said, Don, I don't feel like I deserve this. And he goes, he goes, thank God. He said, thank God we're not sitting in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous where people are getting what they deserve, or these rooms would be empty. He said, I think we're in the mercy business, not the justice business. Matter of fact, you know, nowadays I don't even want what I deserve. Right? And you know what I'm in the denial of when I'm in that state of consciousness? The denial of the grace of God. A form of denial stronger than the denial you came here with. And it's subtle. And it's very powerful. And it'll take anything that I've done so I can take the credit. And there's nothing my ego loves better than to set me up for the big setup of all. You see, if I'm basing my sobriety on circumstance or emotional state, my ego is waiting for the big day. If I'm one of these people, and I did it for a long time, hey, I know God's working in my life because there was a parking place just for me outside of the meeting. And things are going pretty good. That doesn't mean when God's in your life, things don't go pretty good. That just means you better find something else to base it on, because the day it doesn't go real good, your ego will go, see? Told you. He don't love you, but I know something that'll make you feel better. Or if you start to base your experience with God on your emotional state, your ego's just setting you up for the day when you're not feeling great, when you really do need God, and it'll go, see? I told you, He don't love you. So here I was with this man who was taking my drunk log, and he was saying it wasn't like why I'm alcoholic. Because what I was trying to tell this man, I was trying to tell this man that where my drinking took me is what makes me alcoholic. And he was saying, where my drinking took me only separates me from a lot of you, and where my drinking took me isn't why I'm alcoholic. And he encouraged me to take a bottle of alcohol, imagine it right out here in front of me, and skim all the drama off the top of that bottle, and just look at me and a bottle of booze and answer two questions. Can you control it once you start to drink? And once you stop, can you control that stop? Can you keep yourself sober? And I found out why I'm alcoholic several months later. I'd like to say that that night I saw the light and I asked him to be my sponsor. But I didn't. I waited till I was 5.5 months and I hit bottom with the second half of step one. A man put it much better than I can one night when he said he reached a day in Alcoholics Anonymous where he couldn't pull off on purpose what he used to do by mistake. And I'll tell you how I understand that, because drinking, some unbelievable stuff used to happen by mistake, just by grace. Women, relationships, piles of money, jobs, near-death scrapes. I sailed through 18 years of drinking. I had some trouble, but I made it through some unbelievable stuff. And I reached a day in Alcoholics Anonymous at 5.5 months where I woke up and I had been feeling good. And things were going good. The big trap of all. And I woke up one day and I got in touch with the root of my disease, which is a spiritual malady. See, the symptoms are simple. I'm bodily and mentally different. When it goes in my body, I crave more. You don't get that craving for more alcohol when you drink alcohol? You're not alcoholic. That's what joins us. That's what alkies know about. That's what we can talk about, whether you've ever... I sat in my living room with a 70-year-old little black woman from South Central Los Angeles who's never been to treatment, never been to jail, never lost a husband, never had a DUI, barely ever left the house, never got in trouble. And she and I talked about what the big book spends 53 out of 164 pages talking about. And within 20 minutes, she and I saw we are exactly the same. Because we're powerless over alcohol, bodily and mentally. The symptoms are simple. I can't control it in my system. I can't control it when it's not even in my system. Another night I came down from one of those meetings at 1311 York Street and a man did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And he called me over to have some coffee. And he said to me, "What was the topic in the meeting upstairs?" And I said, the topic was alcoholic insanity. That's a term we all hear a lot. He said, what did they all talk about? I said, well, they all talked about the crazy stuff you and I would do under the influence. He shook his head and he said, do you think that's what alcoholic insanity is? And I said, yep. And I did some crazy stuff drinking. He said, what if I could show you the most insane thing you ever did? Was with absolutely nothing in your system. Bone dry, at your very best, further away from your last drink than you'd been in a long time. I said, okay. He said, okay, then make a list of the 10 craziest things you've ever done. And if you're new here tonight and you're not sure what alcoholic insanity is, think of the 3 or 4 most insane things you ever did. So I listed them. Armed robbery, drunk. Stuck a gun in her face, drunk, 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 drunk. They were all drunk. This guy shook his head and he said, what if I could show you the number one most insane, not number 5, not number 8, number one most insane thing you ever did was with nothing in your system. And you know what he did for me that night? He brought me out from behind the bottle. My old excuse. You know how convenient that was? You know, I would rather make amends for an armed robbery that I committed drunk than a lie I told you 10 years sober. You know why? Because an armed robbery that I committed drunk, I can say, hey, I was drunk. But you know what I have to say, a lie I told you 2 years ago? I have to say to you that 10 years sober, I told you this piddly-ass lie about blah, 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 and look you in the face and say, and I did that 10 years away from my last drink. Because you know what he did for me that night? He helped me see that this guy, the most insane thing this guy ever did was to pick up the first drink. And I do that with nothing in my system. 28 days out of the Michigan State Penitentiary, having walked out of my parole officer's office. And I come from a family where that shouldn't have happened. I don't have some of the excuses that some of the people I heard had when they were new. They said they were alcoholic because mommy and daddy abused them. I was spoiled rotten, given everything I ever... My grandfather was vice president of Post Cereal, invented Post Toasties. And I was not supposed to be 19 years old in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Some of you said you were alcoholic because mom and dad were. My dad went to the doctor one day after drinking Chivas Regal his entire life and smoking Camel cigarettes, and the doctor said, if you ever drink again or smoke another cigarette, it's going to kill you. He never had another drink and never smoked another cigarette for another 11 years. I went to the doctor, he told me the same thing. That's a good reason to have a drink. Are you kidding me? Other people's sufficient reasons to not drink was my sufficient reason to drink. Because you know why? I got to drink. I got to drink. I came out of the Michigan State Penitentiary when I was 21 years old and they gave me the conditions of my parole. No ex-felons. Got to stay away from them. No bars, no drugs, can't leave the county, can't drink. You might as well have just cut my throat, because that's my life. That's my life. And you just told me I can't have my life. I never had 28 days in 18 years of drinking. I didn't stay sober in the Michigan. You don't, locking me up doesn't stop me from drinking. Some of the best booze I ever had was in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Some of the best drugs I ever had was in the Michigan State Penitentiary. You don't smuggle in, you don't smuggle into prison bunk drugs. You don't sell bad drugs in the penitentiary. You get really good booze and really good drugs from guards. From guards. From the guys that are keeping you there. And I walked out of his office 28 days out of the Michigan State Penitentiary with a new plan that I was never going to drink or use again. Out of his office, into a bar to pick up a pack of cigarettes, picked up a drink, called the next felon, drove out of the county, and woke up in a dope house 5 days later out of a blackout. And I didn't choose to do that. And I didn't decide to do that. And I didn't want to do that, and it wasn't necessarily, and it wasn't right, and it wasn't called for. Because none of those things have anything to do with why I say I'm alcoholic. Choice today has no more relevance in my life to me being sober than choice did when I got here. It's just another end of the same scale. Those of you sitting here tonight that think you have a choice whether you drink again or not are experiencing the insanity of alcoholism, because in the sunlight of the Spirit, in a fit spiritual condition, there is no more choice to drink than there is to not drink when you got here. The idea that I have a choice is the insanity of alcoholism. I have no choice. I have grace. The problem has been removed. If you're new here tonight, I'll tell you something they sell short. I don't know if they do it up here, but they do it down where I live. And they tell people at these meetings that they're going to read the 12 promises. And they read some great promises that are on page 83, halfway through the ninth step. But they lead you to believe, when you're new, that those are the only 12 promises in our program. I'll tell you what. From the very first page of the very first foreword to the very first book that was ever printed, there are promises from the title page all the way through every step. There are some fabulous promises just before the third step prayer. What about the one returning home from a fifth step, that you'll be able to sit alone at perfect peace and ease? What else have I ever wanted? And you know what I can honestly say to you, those of you that are new? Every time I have ever submitted myself to that process of 1 through 5 and returned home, I have been able to sit alone at perfect peace and ease. We have a lot of means on the ninth step promises that they read as the 12 promises of AA. Why don't we ever have meetings on the 10th step promises just a couple pages later, which contain one of the greatest promises of all if you're alcoholic, and that promise is your problem with alcohol will be removed. It doesn't even exist. You're placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Why don't we have meetings on coming to rely on our own minds and our thought life being placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives? Because very few people ever do the work up to there to ever experience that, because they never finish amends, because they're surrounded by people who tell them, you can't never finish amends. I know 300 or 400 people around this country. Matter of fact, 400 of them met at a conference in Breckenridge, Colorado last July that are members of the family that I belong to, who have finished amends that they're consciously aware of 10, 20, 30, up to 48 years. My great-grand sponsor, Paul Martin from Chicago, who's 49 years sober, who's been doing this work for 49 years, every time they've ever made an 8-step list, to the best of their ability. The book even tells you, even the ones you can't find. So all of a sudden, my 18-year history with alcohol doesn't have much reference to me anymore, except for the truth about me and alcohol, and that is what I can talk to you about. What it's like to wake up and have to have a drink, where choice isn't involved, or to start drinking. And only, I heard a guy one time, he said, Every time he drank, he got drunk because he wanted to. And that's why he's alcoholic. I said, boy, if every time I drank I got drunk and it was still going the way I wanted to, I certainly wouldn't be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I know men and women who drank and wanted to get drunk and couldn't. You know those times where you would drink and it would just get tighter and tighter and tighter, right back to sober? Or the times you wanted to get drunk and you couldn't. You were with the right guys or the right gals to have a whole lot, and you'd have a couple, you'd be flat on your face because your tolerance was all messed up. Or the times you didn't want to drink, but you had to. I know about the truth about my drinking, but I've lost the attachment to the drama of where it took me, because it's not what joins me to you. And I lived long enough using the things that separate me from you to be at a place now where I'm interested in the things that join me to you. I'm tired of doing the stuff that only causes separation. I'm interested in the things that cause unity and that join us. And I know two things, three things, probably several things that join me to every alcoholic in this room. When I start drinking, I lose control. And when I stop drinking, it's only a matter of time before I start drinking, unless something major comes between me and alcohol, like the grace of God. I was at one of these things one time in Arizona at an outdoor thing where everybody was camping, and they had me down the street at some motel, and I came Sunday morning, and my host that had been with me the whole weekend, about 2 minutes before they introduced me, we'd been together the whole morning and he hadn't mentioned this, he leans over and he goes, this is another one of those phrases I'm careful now when somebody says, he says, oh, I forgot to tell you. I went, uh-oh. He said, oh, I forgot to tell you. A lady with 17 years died last night over in the campground of alcohol poisoning. She drank after 17 years and she died here at the conference. And the whole weekend I'd been hearing people, the chairman for the meetings and other people, a couple of speakers, they were all saying things like, we're exactly where we're supposed to be, doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing. And I got up there that morning, and this guy had just told me that, and needless to say, it was kind of on my mind. And I got up there, and what came to my mind was, we're exactly where we shouldn't be, doing something we absolutely shouldn't be doing. And only another alcoholic can understand that. This is not logical. It doesn't make sense. Because the spiritual life is not a theory. You have to have lived it. You have to live it. Another alcoholic doesn't understand with his mind that if you admit you have no power, you receive power, more than you've ever been given. But as long as you thought you had any at all, you never got any more than you already had, which was probably little or nothing at all. Then they tell you, and it doesn't make any sense, man, if you ever do get anything here, what we want you to do with it right away is give it away? Yeah. Then what we want you to do, they tell you, don't make any major decisions in your first year, and about 3 months later they're asking you to decide to turn your entire will and life over to the care of God. Right? Oh, no major decision there. Right? My friend says they tell you not to get in a relationship with a year, but nobody knows if that works or not because no one's ever made it. So in my first few months before I got to be lucky enough to find someone that knows how to do this work, in my first 5 months I'm sitting in a meeting in North Denver where there's men that care more about you than how you might feel about what they might say, and I'm doing the old AA shuffle. Now I don't know if anyone else in the room has ever done the AA shuffle, but it goes like this. I turned it over, and I took it back. And I turned it over, and I took it back. And this old guy stands up and he says, son, why don't you shut up and sit down? And you know what? I had drank enough alcohol to shut up and sit down. You know the great persuader with more power than any mother, father, lover, husband, wife, therapist? the thing that Book calls the great persuader that can beat you into a state of reasonableness, where when somebody says something like that, you can sit down and shut up, right? Thank God for alcohol. Thank God for every drop I ever drank. And I learned that night to ask the second greatest question I ever learned to ask in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the first, the second. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, if you're still doing that, you haven't turned it over. There's a difference between the decision at the third step and the commitment that follows." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you tell someone to go sit in the corner and pray for ham and eggs, and they decide to do that, and they go sit in the corner and they pray for ham and eggs, they'll probably starve to death. But if you tell someone to go sit in the corner and pray for ham and eggs, and they decide to do that, and they go sit in the corner and they pray for ham and eggs, and get up and make one hell of a commitment, they'll probably eat ham and eggs." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "There's a difference between the decision at the third step and the commitment that follows." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It's like a chicken and a pig." Walking down the road, they come to a big sign on the church that says, "Help feed the poor." The chicken looks at the pig and he says, "We ought to do something about that hunger problem." The pig says, "What could we do about a hunger problem?" The chicken says, "We could feed those poor people ham and eggs."
I'm setting you up.
The pig had a little more sense than I did when I took the third step, because he said to the chicken, "For you, that's just a simple decision to lay some eggs, but for me, that's one hell of a commitment." I didn't get it. I didn't get it. Several months later, when I met this man that knew how to do this work, we started on the title page. I found out I wasn't in AA. That was a shocker. Going to meetings didn't mean I was in AA, because there was three parts to this program, and no one ever told me that there's unity, recovery, and service, and just because you're going to meetings doesn't mean you're in AA. It just means you're a member of the fellowship. And then they really scared me, and they said the only requirement to be a member isn't the only requirement for sobriety, because the strongest desire is of absolutely no avail. Don't ever ask me to repeat what I just said. Then I found out what's wrong with me. Somewhere between the doctor's opinion and we agnostic, I found out that I'm bodily and mentally and spiritually different, because I get a physical craving when I drink, a mental obsession when I'm not drinking, and at the root, at the core, way down there in my being, the thing that keeps me here, the thing that keeps me in this program, the thing that keeps me in the steps and the fellowship and service, is that I have a malady of the spirit. And I need a spiritual awakening for a spiritual problem. And that's what I've been pouring booze on since before my first drink. That's what's been there when I was sitting in my parents' backyard, 10 years old, 3 years before I ever took a drink, dreaming that a spaceship was going to land and a little green man was going to get out and he was going to say, "You weren't born here on this planet. We brought you here as a teeny baby. This has just been a test." And I would have gone, "Yeah, yeah." But that didn't happen till I met Don P., 5.5 months sober, when I was ready for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't ready for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was beat by 18 years of drugs and alcohol. I was ready for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I saw that further away from my last drink than I'd ever been in 18 years, my life is unmanageable, sober. And they showed me a description in the chapter to the agnostic in the middle of page 52 that describes untreated alcoholism, not the human condition. Not a condition that you have to settle for, I don't care how long you've been sober, it's a description of untreated alcoholism. When you're having trouble with personal relationships, and you can't control your emotional nature, and you're prey to misery and depression, and you can't make a living, and you're full of fear, and you're unhappy, and you can't seem to be a real help to other people. I was dying of a part of the disease I didn't even know I had. And I needed someone to point it out to me. And I needed someone that said I could get free in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Another time I wanted to get free, in the middle of my first inventory, when I was feeling some forgiveness in my heart for a man who was 57 when I was born, and by the time I was 10, he was 67. And he wasn't doing the stuff your dads were doing. And he wasn't showing up for the games. And he wasn't playing with me. And he wasn't doing that stuff. And in the middle of my first inventory, in a part of that inventory where it asked me to look at my selfishness and my dishonesty and my self-seeking and my fear, with every resentment I ever had toward that man, I saw a 10-year-old kid playing God way before he ever took a drink, because I knew how old he should have been, how he should have been doing it, what he should have been doing it, and how he should have been way before I ever took a drink. And that's playing God, because I knew better than God. A guy got me one time and he said, if you want to see if you play God or not, just think of this. If you had something to do with your own creation, wouldn't you have done a little better job? And in the middle of my first inventory, I made the mistake of saying something in an AA meeting about wanting to get free. And you know what I said in that meeting? I said, for the first time in 31 years, I'm starting to feel some forgiveness for a man that I've resented since my earliest memory. Do any of you think I'll be able to make amends to a man who's been dead since I was 21? And you know what 3/4 of the room said? Can't make amends to someone who's dead. You'll never be able to do that. And you know what they were saying underneath it all? God isn't everything. He's finite. And you know what they were expressing? Their agnosticism. But you know what the other fourth of that room said, those of you that I like to stick with nowadays? Because you know when they say stick with the winners, you know what that means? There's losers. Because the other fourth of the room said, sure you can, go for it. We know your sponsor. Do exactly what he says when you get to the ninth step, because you can make amends to someone who's dead. And all I had to do was see my part and admit that to someone I wasn't really sure I could trust yet. And then ask a God that I wasn't even sure about to remove that stuff and place me in a position where I could go to Him with forgiveness in my heart and put His name on a 3x5 card and write all the stuff I was clear on that I ever did to hurt Him. And then sit at His grave and say a prayer and read that stuff like I was face to face and walk out of that graveyard free of feelings that have never come back to this day, that have changed, that have been healed from hate to admiration, from resentment to love. I had a really neat man in my life that I could have gotten a whole lot more from than I did. And two brothers that showed up for the games and the baseball and the stuff that I wanted him to show up for. And I couldn't even see it. Thanks so much for asking me to come.